Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight's show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and science issues and other related and unrelated subjects. It's going to be on the following. I thought it would be good tonight to talk about God's mental dimension of mind. Now, most people, I've talked about the mental plane to some extent and the mental dimension, but most people do not understand what this dimension is about. That's why I have a subheading to tonight's show, which is creation/cause, love/wisdom, and form/manifestation. Those are the parts of the manasic or mental plane that also help to develop the remaining two lower planes, the astral and the physical, of course, where we exist right now. And so they all connect together, and they're all actually related to the manasic or mental plane. So in a weird kind of way, you can say that the three planes are expressed through the higher or the highest of the three, or the manasic plane, and then the lower two are more defined and more dense and have certain other qualities to them. But today I want to make sure that we have a pretty good understanding, hopefully by the end of the show, of what this is all about. Now, why do I mean or call it God's dimension of mind? Well, because I'm talking about mind as we or human beings understand it. What we think of as our mind is predominantly a mental aspect and mostly a mental realization to human beings. We do have a mind dimension, literally, on the astral and in the physical world, but those dimensions of mind are more obscure and difficult for people to understand because it seems as though we have accepted as a common practice that the mind is something about thinking and thinking in a mental way. There's other ways to think, and I'll mention those in tonight's show. And I've mentioned them in many other shows, so some of you already know this, and if you've read any of my articles or textbook or whatever, you would know that as well. Okay, so let's get into what I'm talking about. And I like defining things at the beginning of the show so that it kind of, from that point forward, we have an equal footing on what I'm trying to talk about. You may not agree with it, of course, and you can call in and say, hey, you know what, I don't agree with you. And that's okay. You know, I mean, occasionally I have that. Someone calls up and says, you know, I don't agree with you. Okay, that's all right. If you aren't by a number, if you're on a phone right now and listening and not by a computer, I'll give you the U.S. number, 877-876-5227. So you could not only listen to the show, but you could call in. You might have to hang up to do that if you're only using one phone, but there's other options, I guess, to some people. Now, let me go into this idea of dimensionality. What do I mean, God's dimension of mind? Well, in order to have, in human terms, what most people consider to be a mind, for human beings, we think that human beings that have minds are able to think in the past, the present, and the future. People or things, including animals, that we think are mindless or lacking mind, in a mental sense now, because that's how we tend to define it being human beings, are creatures that don't think very much in the future, usually, and their understanding of the present circumstances may be somewhat limited. So those kinds of creatures, and that's a whole array of kinds of animals, and of course for plants, most people don't even think plants think, but if they do, they certainly don't think about stuff in the future, and probably not much in the present. They have any realization, maybe they have something going on about some distant occurrence around them. But And to us, that it seems reasonable to assume that. So getting into this idea, when we talk about mind, we're also talking about time. We're talking about how someone or something perceives what we call time. What is time? Well, one way to understand this question, because it's very much connected to the mental dimension. Again, I will cover why that's the case. But one way to explain what time is that time involves how intelligent activity is represented in space. So, and what is intelligent activity? Well, intelligent activity is the ability to communicate and or move from one part of what we call space to another, and from one event that may take place in space to another, and if it's communication, from one being to another. Okay, so all of that is going on if we're talking about what is time. Time is, in a sense, a measure of how intelligent an activity actually is. So I say intelligent activity, it's a relative term. An ultimately expressive intelligent activity takes no time at all to communicate or move from one part of space to another. No time at all. And something that is less than perfectly and ultimately intelligent in its activity takes time. So time is a measure of the intelligence of activity. And you could say, okay, what do you mean by intelligence? Intelligence is the ability to move and or communicate. And the greater that ability is, and the closer it is to the method and to the general concept of what God is, the more it is intelligent. So things become unintelligent when they don't use the methods of God and they don't generally have the concept of what God is in them. They don't have to think the same way as God. As a matter of fact, they may create something new, but it has to be within the general concept of God, and he has to use a method that was created by God. And you can say, well, how could somebody create something that isn't a method created by God? Well, there are ways. You could reverse, as an example. I'll just give you an example. You could reverse something that God created, make it the opposite. Those are the easiest things to do. A thing called evil can do that and does it all the time. And so if you reverse things, just a literal reversal, something could still move through space, and it could still, amazingly, communicate. But it does so in a way that no longer is defined as intelligent, because it's doing it in a way that's opposite from God. And you can say, well, why would that, why be so prejudiced? Why make it that it's unintelligent? Why can't something be unintelligent in the reverse of God? Well, because the outcome in the process is that it ends up wasting a huge amount of time. It may not take any time or very little time to communicate something, but the communication itself wastes so much time if it's exercised by those that you're communicating to that it's highly unintelligent. Okay. So you have to add together not only the time it takes to communicate the message, but how long is the message useful in further communicating and further acting with others, and if it wastes huge amounts, which evil does, of that, then as an example, that's proof that then it's unintelligent. So time is a measure of this thing, and it's part of space. There's no such thing as being able to either travel through space from one event to another or from one place to another or communicate from one person to another or one thing to another. It's absolutely impossible to do either of those things without there being some measure of time involved. So time is a condition or a part of space that separates from space and is visible to us whenever something is less than perfectly intelligent in its activity. Does that make sense to you? I hope it does. I know it's complicated, but I try to say it in a way that it's kind of simple. So let's say that I'm going to communicate with you, and I pick up the phone, I give you a call, and I give you some information, and you say, wow, that's great, thanks. Well, in all of that, there's some amount of time that has been separated from space. So the communication was not perfect, because perfect communication would be instantaneous. There would be no time at all. But if it was done pretty efficiently, and most importantly, if the communication was very helpful, so that the next time you did it with someone else or back to me, less time was done than the time before that, then you might say that that has some level of intelligence to it, and it's growing towards God's mind. But if it's doing the opposite, then we might say, oh, no, that's going against God's mind, and a lot of time is separated from space in those situations. And we call that a lot of wasted time. Some people refer to it as mistakes, but oftentimes these quote-unquote mistakes are quite deliberate. And I always think of a mistake as being something other than a deliberate act. So that's where the confusion can come in. Time is a part of space that gives us a quality of the activity that is taking place in the space. It literally gives us the quality of all of the third part of God's mind. Because the third part of God's mind deals with energy and form and the manifestation of those within space. Wow, isn't that cool? Yeah, I think it is. So it's just a neat thing that we can understand time in a totally different and new way, which is going to help us to then get an idea of what the mental dimension is like. Why is that? Well, you see, in the mental dimension, a part of the space is the full aspect of time itself. Now, I know we all live in the physical world, right? You're hearing me talk to you in the physical world. But in the physical world, time is the majority of the dimensional part of time, where you can directly sense with your senses what time is missing. We can't feel a lack of the future or the present in terms of time. We can only sense or feel, actually both of those are correct, sense in an astral sense and physically sense time while we're physically alive in a past sense. So although a lot of people say, well, I can instantly tell when something has happened, really what they really mean to say is a fraction of a second later, they can sense time. As time is moving, though, in this dimension of time and space, we human beings have an awful time, an awful difficulty in sensing time in the present. We more often imagine it than can really sense it. We have astral feelings that actually can sense it, but they're so weak and so overpowered by our physical sense of reality that we don't notice it. And it's very, very difficult for people to say that they do. The future part of time, absolutely, people are, almost all people, there's a few, very, very few, who can sense anything about future time. while they're physically alive. It's a difficult thing. Even though our minds are mostly in the mental world, which again, we will cover more about, even though that's true, the overpowering nature of physical sense blocks that reality from us. And so our sense of time is extremely limited. And our understanding of time is so illusioned. We think it's sort of like some kind of thing that we can't really describe very easily, but it's like minutes on a clock, and it just things just happen within it. And we don't notice any of the other qualities of time. But in the mental world, that's not true. In the mental world, human beings that live in the mental world, of course, they've already lived in the physical and astral by the time they get to the mental, they have only their mental senses left as individual or uniquely separated sense. Whatever they created in virtue, in God, with God, together with God, in the lower dimensions, the astral and the physical worlds, they did virtuous things there. Then while they were doing those virtuous things, the sense that they use at that time, the amount of sense that they use, which might be a very small amount, depends how virtuous they lived, became fused over time together. And so the mental sense has some fused physical and astral sense. Not a lot, but it helps a little bit to be able to still understand what it was like to sense in the astral and physical world for some people. But in the mental world, if you want to sense things, you've got to use mental senses anyway. And those are really, really obscure. If I asked 1,000 people, tell me about your mental senses. Probably 999 would say, huh? What are you talking about? Why this guy's out to lunch, you know? Mental senses are very subtle because they deal with a very subtle form both of energy and they deal with the most subtle elements of time. Now, what's subtle about time in terms of the present and the future, particularly the future? Well, what's subtle about the future is that in our understanding of it from the physical world, which is where we get so well trained about it, the future has yet to occur. And nobody can sense or understand anything about it. So you just got to wait around for it to happen. Mm-hmm. People in the mental world do not experience the future part of time that way. Let me try to describe it to you. If we were in the mental world and we were awake, fully conscious there. There's a lot of people in the mental world that are not in this state, but we'll assume we were. That means we had full use of our senses, full use of our mental senses. And now, let's say we wanted to experience something that's going to happen a month from now. We don't have to wait a month to experience it. We can experience that event or those events that we're going to think about a month from now. Now, provided our mental sense is unified and balanced and completely perfected, we'll say, with our sense of time in the past and the present. If that's true, if those are perfected, then our mental sense of the future could be right now. Now, what does that mean? That means we can think about the future, and by being perfectly in tune with the past and the present, we will know exactly what's going to happen in the future because everything that's going to happen in the future is predicated on what has already happened in the past and the present. Now, you can say, no, wait. That may be true, but you're not a determinist, so what? Yeah, we know that. So what about people creating new things? Well, that's okay, because you see, in the meta world, you're also involved with those who are going to be doing the creating, and they can co-create with you together. And then you absolutely do know what the future is going to be. You really do. And you could say, well, okay, but what if it's about something that's not going to happen in the mental world, but it's going to happen in the physical or the astral sometime in the future? That's a different thing. Because those folks that are going to live there, even if it's yourself sometime in the future, are going to be mostly absent the mental sense that you're now using in the mental world. And so you're going to have somewhat different outcomes. And that's where the rub comes. You can't predict the future when you start going outside the dimension in human beings. You could in superhumans who unify these senses. And you can do it only for superhumans. You couldn't predict what the future is going to be with humans because humans still are a wild card because their senses aren't working very well for the present and particularly the future in the lower two dimensions. Ah, now it starts making a little bit of sense, maybe, to some of you, that this is really about life in the mental world and how someone experiences life there, but you can't borrow it and bring it down to the physical world for all people because their senses won't be operating in the same way, unfortunately. So different outcomes may come about. You can kind of alleviate or minimize the negative effects from that condition, but you still may not be very accurate. You can only really know what's going on for those who are fully awake and fully operational, fully using their senses correctly in the mental world. There you can actually determine what the future is going to be for that place and that time. So you have to be in the dimension that you are trying to live in the future of in order to get accuracy. You can't be living in a lower dimension. It won't work as well, at least. So this is an interesting point when we realize that the mental world means not only living in the past and the present, but also living in the future. And it's a very, very difficult thing for someone who hasn't experienced this to either accept or to even imagine. Because imagining is part of the astral world, and the mental is beyond that, far beyond it. Okay, so this is kind of a really fascinating subject because the mental dimension is a much more complicated dimension in time and space. We're adding two full more dimensions to the single, although it seems like three dimensions, the single dimension of the physical world. The three dimensions of the physical world, both in metaphysics and in physics, are considered one dimension. But the most important thing here is to realize that if we take those three dimensions, whether you consider them one or not, and you add another dimension to them, progressively, the next dimension is not time. A lot of people say, oh, it's the time, the fourth dimension. Maybe time is really the fifth dimension. You only add an increased part of time when you go to the astral world. What you really add is the sense of and the ability to move in the direction and the speed and the, we'll call it, some phase, it's a little hard for some people to understand, of energy itself. So you can be in the same three-dimensional space with, say, a friend of yours, but one of you is directing your thought, which is creative imagination, not mental thinking, in the astral world, in a direction that's away from yourself and helping others. And you, let's say you're doing that, or your friend's doing that. Let's say you are directing your thoughts about very selfish things. You and your friend would not even know that you're together at that time. Because the time and space would separate between the two of you. Because the direction of the energy, and its phase as well, but other things about it, are changed now for one compared to the other. And you're actually going to find yourself in different locales. But three of the four dimensions are the same. But this fourth dimension, which is a whole dimension itself of energy, changes everything. And so to the person who is more conscious, they may be able to experience the person who is much less conscious, but not vice versa. And that's not always true. It's a relative amount. And sometimes the person who's more conscious might actually have to be in a higher subdimension to really experience where the other person is. This is fascinating stuff. So the dimensionality of mind is considerably different for people who, say, are very focused in the mental world on their past, called the mental akasha. And they're very... The energy in their past is what they're concerned about, and events that took place in their past. So they're not using in time much of the present sense, nor are they using any of the future sense. So they're kind of like almost in a dream state where they're only partially conscious, going through over and over again past experiences where they were egotistical and or arrogant, either in the whole lifetime, both while they were physically in astral life, and even sometimes in prior lifetimes that they never resolved. They go over these over and over again, and they're not connected by time. They're connected by the commonality of the selfishness of the experience. So one moment you could be in a lifetime 3 lives ago, and then you could, the next moment you could be in another experience in this past lifetime, but while you were physically alive. There's a similarity, a common context, and so people can go through that. Sometimes they can jump around by 10, 15, 20 years, 50 years in a lifetime because of a commonality of experience. Going through these Akashic experiences, trying to bring them into at least the present so that they are no longer just them acting out in a past event in an egotistical way, but rather changing through conscious thinking in their mental body how to behave, how to interact, how to change their thinking so that they weren't closed in their thinking, but thinking in ways where they have humility and open-minded to other people's thoughts. Once they got that going, they start remedying their senses. And sure enough, their past experiences start joining with their present experiences in time. Time is another part of the monastic dimension now that they start building up in themselves. And then eventually they can live in the future part of time as time is and exists in the mental world with other people. Wow! If they're caught in the Akashic experience, they can't. And they can only live alone, literally isolated from other people. There may be people in the Akashic experience, but those are past events. They're not really happening in the present. Isn't that fascinating? I find it fascinating. Time, I love time. Time is much more interesting once you start understanding it from the inside out rather than as we tend to experience it in the physical world. So, these folks have a lot of work to do to get over all of these times that they were egotistical, abusing their senses of mental sense and separating the mental sense, especially involving time, and reducing their ability to think. Reducing their ability to join their conceptual mind, which is a new idea they're bringing in, with their concrete mind. Now, what is the difference? A concept. What is a concept? A concept answers the question why. Oftentimes, you can put the word because at the end of part of a statement. This and this happened because, and then the rest of the statement explains the concept. Why? Concepts are formulas of thought. They are not examples. You can talk about a concept, but you can't actually define the concept with just a certain type or amount of words. The concept is a formula. It's actually better explained in mathematical terms than even in language terms. That's why it's difficult for many people to understand what a concept is, because it has to do to some extent about math. And you might say, well, what do you mean math? Well, it's a formula, just like mathematical formulas exist. And the formula is not like how to figure out the number of inches in the sides of a certain kind of triangle using a formula, or how to figure out one side in, when you know two sides, such as a squared plus b squared equals c squared, if you're familiar with that theorem. So it's a formula, but it's not that kind of formula. It's a much, much bigger kind of formula. What is it a formula about? It's a formula that does three things if it's a formula that is complete. And a complete concept always does these three things. You ready? They're part of tonight's show. It is a cause or a creation. That's the first thing it does. The second thing is it brings things together. It builds consciousness, which is called love wisdom. Okay, and the third thing that it does is it produces and can produce infinite amounts and varieties of form, and can manifest that in the lower mental mind, which then can, those things can then be manifested in astral thought and eventually astral energy and then physical thought and physical energy. So that's what a concept is. That's why concepts are so very important. The bigger the concept, the more it causes creation, love, wisdom, and form to be created. The forms are called thought forms, the forms of thought. You know that a concept is accurate when it completes all three of those things in a balanced way, and there are no contradictions in any of the forms that are manifested. If there's a contradiction where you try to make a certain form and it won't work with the concept you're using, then the concept is incomplete or invalid for that kind of form production. We say that a concept is untruthful when it doesn't produce the forms of thought that aren't completely compatible with it. Some concepts are truthful for some forms of thought, but in a vast number of other ones are not. Therefore, they're truthful as long as the knowledge that they're coming from is limited. But when you expand that knowledge, you end up with thought forms that are highly contradicted. And then the person realizes that concept is no longer, for that set of purposes, valid. It doesn't create truth. So now we know something about truth. Truth is kind of based upon how much knowledge and how well you use this knowledge to create a concept with. And if you are limited in your knowledge, at some points, you may think something is truthful, but then as you become less limited, the truth may go away because the concepts you've been using, or the concept or concepts you've been using, are no longer big enough to make truthful forms of thought. Tell me, that isn't heavy. Wow. That's a biggie. Let's talk a little bit more about cause and creation, love and wisdom, and form and manifestation. And I'll let your brains cool off a little bit while I explain the little pieces of this. It might make more sense to you over time as we get this. So if we look at this, what do we mean by creation and cause? Well, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. They're supposed to be. The first part of God's mind, for those of you who aren't familiar with that, they define the purpose. They help to expand God. So when we're talking about creation, we're not talking about creation of just any old thing. Things that are whole in a concept and produce some level of truth for that period of time that we're using it expands God. And that's what I mean by creation. They're creation because they're part of the Creator. Now, what if someone is destructive, like evil? And they say, well, the way I create is by destroying everything. Well, of course, that's kind of a nutty thing to say, but because what they're really saying is they don't create anything. They create destruction, which is the lack of creation. But we'll call it that if they want, like. So their form of creation is destruction. And gee, they get to be better and better destroyers. Does that produce truth? No, it does the opposite. So anytime someone is there to be destructive to their creator, God, they are at the same time being untruthful. And we can make a sweeping statement that in order to be destructive, those that are doing so for the purpose of being destructive, which means that they're moving towards the dark side and or are dark and or are evil, are doing so because they don't want there to be a God, and in so doing that, they are always destroying some part of the truth. So we can say that evil does not support truth, and truth helps to destroy evil. Truth helps to destroy destruction of God. Truth is a good thing. How can we further define truth? Well, I'll get to that, because you have to know all three of these in a balanced way to understand truth. So let's move to the next one, love, wisdom. Love is the thing that brings, it's the second part of God's mind, it's part of it, and it brings things together that in some way helps to grow God again. I mean, you can bring things together, just destructive as all get out. But this is brings things together so it helps to bring more of God into others. That's the first part of love. And you say, well, what the heck is wisdom then? Wisdom is the ability to help others to become more loving while you're being loving. So love, wisdom is much more important than just being loving. Because you could be loving towards someone or something and be very unhelpful, maybe even be destructive to them. But if you're practicing love wisdom, love in a wise way, then you're helping them to become more loving themselves, and they're doing the same with others, and it keeps the whole thing growing. Wow, that's cool. That's the second part. Okay, and what's the third thing? Form manifestation. Well, in order to create good thought forms and to have that manifested in some way, it can be manifested in the mental world in three parts of time, it can be manifested in the astral world predominantly in two parts of time, and it can be manifested in the physical world, which predominantly is going to be affected by just the past. But still, the other two parts of time may be present to some extent, depending upon how much you can include other people's senses of what you're trying to express in your manifestation to them about the astral and the mental worlds. So let's say you're a writer, and you want to write something that you don't care about how people feel, if it's truthful or not, and you don't care how people think, if that's truthful enough. You just want to write a story that's kind of entertaining, and it makes them feel as though the time from their past has some meaning to them, and it is a way of getting their sense of meaning from usually a more superficial expression. So you write something, you're using thought forms when you write, even though the words on the page may not, the words themselves may not, but when they're manifested in the mind of the reader, say, that's the thought form. It's going off in her head. But because you don't use law of wisdom, and because you're not being creative for a particular purpose in mind, a cause, causal reason, to help a person really gain a bigger picture of the whole situation, because those are missing, then what you write is kind of very mundane. It lacks the expression of all of God, and it does not represent truth. And a person knows it doesn't represent truth because those other conditions are missing, and that's how they know, that's how all of us know it's something that's truthful. It's got to have these three elements to it, and they have to be reasonably balanced. Not any one of them is just like a super way off the scale, a whole bunch of thought forms and just a little tiny bit of creation cause and a little bit of love wisdom in there. Well, that doesn't cut it. So truth is these three things balanced, and it is in the mind of one person, oftentimes communicated to another. But it can be only in the mind of the person themselves, in which case they find truth. And then they may try to help others to find the same truth by doing all three of these things. So when someone speaks the truth, they're not just doing something in a mental way. I know some people believe that to be true, but it's not. They are doing three things. They're intelligently coordinating with that other person in a physical sense. They are helping the other person to feel in their astral body feelings that are connected to God, love, and helping them to become more inclusive and loving themselves while that person is understanding the cause of whatever effects are taking place, and it allows them to become more creative themselves, and they understand what it is you're creating all at the same time. Then you've got truth. Hey, cool. Well, you know what? I've gone way over here. I'm looking at the clock, and I'm sort of off in my own dream world here. I'm not way over. I'm a few minutes up. So we're going to go ahead and take a break. Hopefully the engineer has been following me a little bit here. And we'll come back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And I even confused myself. I'm coming back from the break. I lost track of time there for a second. I'm talking to someone else here in the studio. So, at any rate, I hope that that kind of made sense to some of you out there. I hope it made sense to everybody, actually, but I may be hoping too much, but that all this kind of fits together. Truth is a very important element, and it comes from the three parts of the dimension of the mental world. We can't know truth if we don't have a mental mind. Truth only comes through to those beings that have a mental mind. And they generally are very advanced animals and people. That's about it for anything lower than that doesn't have it. Higher, of course, they do. But so if you go to a fly and you want to find out if the fly knows the truth, it's not going to. Yeah. And probably even a lot of fish won't. See, the problem with truth is that most people think that it may not exist at times. Can't find it. And that usually has to do with there being too many times that the concepts that they've been thinking in have been too narrow. And they keep coming up with contradictions in forms of thought or thought forms that don't support one concept or more that they think in. And then they get the feeling and correctly sense that there isn't truth in that with that concept. But then they may go on to believe, and so a lot of people, this is, I mean, a vast number of people have had this experience. I don't know if everybody does it all the time. I'm saying they don't. I hope they don't. But this is common if someone has had this experience. And they can't find the truth because the concept isn't large enough that they're thinking. And sometimes our ability to think in very large concepts has to do with how much truth we've created in our mind in the first place. So if people don't have a lot of truth, they have trouble finding new truth. And they may become, unfortunately, disappointed in the ability to believe there is truth. Then you can become a true existentialist in the worst of cases, unfortunately. Sort of denying that part. Also, hand in hand with this, and I say this with great sadness, is that the people who have trouble finding truth become equivocators and also, at the same time, have trouble finding God. They may go to church, and they may claim to believe, quote-unquote, in God, but if you don't find God by finding truth mentally, and human beings need to do this, then God becomes shallow and lacking an important, extremely important quality. Because truth is the virtue, the light of God that is created in the mental world by thinking in the whole dimension of the mental world, which are the creation cause, love, wisdom, and four manifestation aspects of balanced thinking mentally. You got to have good senses mentally, too, or you won't have that experience of finding truth, very often, anyway. I think the greater damage in not experiencing truth is to not experience God. The truth itself may or may not be a problem in not understanding it and not having a grasp on it. But the lack of experiencing God is a bigger problem, because that can lead to all kinds of disastrous life decisions, amazing sense of loneliness, no matter how much the person may have contact with others, and a sense of foreboding about one's life. People who go to the mental world after they have died from the astral spend a lot of time grappling with that issue. They not only are caught in the Akasha, but when they come out of the Akasha and they sit and meditate about their experiences, one of the reasons they find it so hard to change is because their lack of truth in themselves causes them to not see God enough and not even believe in God enough. Although it's really not in the mental world, it's not as much a belief as it is an understanding and being convinced of it. But regardless, these poor folk can waste hundreds of years of time, not just because they were egotistical or arrogant in the prior life, but more importantly, because of this unbelievably devastating sense or lack of sense of God. That's the bigger problem. The people who serve those people from time to time, they serve them while they're in a conscious state. They serve them while they're in the present. And they're not fully conscious in the Akasha, so they serve them there by manipulating sometimes what's going on in the Akasha. But in the conscious state, they literally do more talking to them rather than about logic and reason, et cetera, which we're going to talk about further tonight. But they talk to them about how it is they're not seeing God and how the truth is evading them. And that, many times, is the most successful way to bring these people out of this self-imposed isolation, which is just devastating. Could you imagine spending hundreds of years? To them, it's real years, just like it is to us here. Unable to communicate with anybody other than these helpers who are like angelic beings to them. And people from their past in a kind of rerun of the rerun of the rerun of the 500th time they've gone through trying to say the truth, find the truth, finally sensing what the other person's mind is about and expanding their own. Their lack of truth comes from not just the fact that they were arrogant or egotistical, it's because they never gained anything from other people because they blocked everybody else's phone. And he never created anything that was connected to the bigger picture because they were so focused on themselves, especially arrogant people. That's true. So it's an interesting idea here that so many people talk about the truth all the time. I mean, people say, well, gee, what I really want for a life mate is somebody who tells me the truth all the time and is truthful about this and that. You hear that. Is that what they really mean? How about if they said this instead? What I want with someone I'm willing to spend the rest of my physical and maybe astral and mental life with, is someone or some people, because this doesn't have to be a romantic thing, be a group of people, who are here and then and in the future, to co-create with me more of truth as a virtue in the world, and who have a balanced sense of the causes of effects or creation, and love and wisdom and form and manifestation all together. Those people are helping me while I'm helping them all to become a greater connection with their creator or God. Those are the people I want to spend my life with. little different, I guess, than saying you just want to have somebody that tells you the truth. But the interesting point about this is that even at the most mundane levels, truth is a valued virtue. It is. But the problem is you can never tell someone the truth. You can only help to create truth in their mind by communicating with them in a way in which they become more integrated in these three things that I just mentioned than less. Sometimes you have to tell them a bold-faced lie, by our definition of lying, in order to get people to bring these three things together because they are so egotistical that if you said something that was not a lie, they would completely reject it and never become more loving or wise or more clear in their form creation, and they would never be any more creative or create concepts that are true causes of the effects in their thought. This is a remarkable problem, isn't it? Sounds upside down, too. But it's no different than people saying they can't find truth, and they don't believe there is any, or they equivocate truth. What is equivocation in truth? Well, it's sort of like politically correct speech for some people. It means that a person invents something they believe to be the truth based more upon how they feel and how other people feel than how they truly conceptually think and compare that to the manifestation of their concepts or thought forms, as you say. That being the case, that's a real big issue, because that means that how they feel becomes their leading thought, not their thought, mental thought. That's called a common monastic way of thinking. Most people think that way more often than they think mentally. Wow. That's kind of scary. I know. Now, why is that the case? Well, we're actually born that way. The race of humans that presently exist on Earth came from an earlier race, earlier couple of races of humans on the planet in physical form, and even before that, in non-physical form, there were humans. But the physical form humans before us were unable to disconnect how they felt first before they thought mentally, using their mental senses. And since they couldn't get to that level, they evolved, you can say. They were us, in many cases, in much prior, earlier lifetimes. And so we carry that with us in our spiritual genes. It's part of our DNA, you could say, in a physical, but also in a metaphysical and spiritual sense. And therefore, we're literally born that way. Only a few people on the planet right now have broken that connection and cannot and would not be fooled by their own feelings into how they think they're finding truth in their mind. They're colored all too often by how they feel. Terrible, terrible problem. Not one that we really want to have as our legacy for the future. So we're going to need to have some of the tools that I'm discussing this evening if we're going to move ahead as human beings in the world. Because eventually, we've got to overcome this common monastic, emotional, mental connection and make our thoughts mentally the primary and ultimate sense of how we find truth. Remember, you can't find the truth if you're not creating it. Can't read the truth, you can't have people tell you the truth if you aren't co-creating with them at the same time using your own senses. People tell me, well, I'm trying to get to the truth, I'm reading this or that. Well, they can read it, but if they are not thinking and they're not going through the concepts themselves and comparing that to the thought forms and challenging them, the truth will elude them. They'll be, may be able to parrot back the words they read. But the real truth, the understanding of God itself, will be missing from their experience. So they may read Light Shed Meaning, a textbook I wrote. Very, very complete, big concepts, potentially a lot of truths, for those people who can follow the concepts, challenge those concepts in their own mind, see if they can find any examples of those concepts that are wrong. And if they can't, then they say, oh, well, I think I've learned a new truth now that I gave to myself by doing the things I just said. Passively, we cannot get to the truth. We have to actively be thinking and challenging what people call the truth to us. Then you experience truth. Or you experience the truth that the truth isn't true. Okay? That's all right. But then you find a bigger truth in the process that you can create yourself. So just to say, well, everything that isn't true in the world is harming everything, it's not true. It does come to help to find out the mistakes that people have made in the past and the things they thought in the past or the things they presently think that are wrong. Because then we can find greater truth. Something that was true maybe 100 years ago is no longer true today. The knowledge has vastly increased. The concepts are much larger. The old ones that used to work don't work anymore. Isaac Newton, in the 17th century, came up with a mechanical model of the physics of the universe. Brilliant. He mathematically computed everything and believed that God was the great architect of the universe with universal laws. You follow the laws, you can figure out anything. Hey, sounded great, a little deterministic, to say the least, but nonetheless, cool. He came up with this whole system, invented several kinds of mathematics to support it, including two different kinds of calculus, and came up with a whole bunch of other stuff. It was just absolutely amazing. Guess what? It's all wrong. It's not true. But it's great stuff. And we use it today still, even though we know it's not true. Some people do anyway. No, it's not true. Yeah, I mean, it's just great stuff. And for his time and age, it took them away from a totally astral experience of God into the mental world, where they use mostly their lower mental mind and smaller concepts to understand their creator. And those concepts for a while created a truism for them. And it wasn't until a guy named Maxwell and a few other people in the 19th century started to discover that this stuff was all hogwash, it wasn't working, that things weren't where you thought they were, and on top of that, everything that seemed to be a solid thing was actually a wave as well. And before long, nobody could understand what any of the stuff that poor Isaac came up with was worth anything. Except it's great if you're not dealing with extreme accuracy, if you're not dealing with the true nature of the universe, it's great stuff. But if you are dealing with those things, which we are more and more today, it's worthless. If you try to put up GPS satellites, you know, using Newtonian physics, they won't work. None of them ever work. Guaranteed. Why not? Well, they're moving around the planet at too far a distance away and at too fast a speed to work under the old untruths of motion that Newton came up with. Those theories of motion work fine as long as you don't go up and become a satellite. Because once you become one of those, you're not going to be able to pinpoint anything and the satellites won't even be able to communicate properly together, and their clocks will all be off. And when your clocks are off, you can't determine where anything is in time and space together. So GPS is becoming useless. Yep, that's just the beginning of the problem. When I go to the moon in a rocket ship, Newtonian physics may not get you there. It may not. Depends on how fast you're going to go and certain other conditions. So, and then if you're really going far, I mean, if you're going to one of the planets, you're really going to get in trouble. So, and if you're going to another star, you're really a mess. Because then the greater the distances, the faster the speeds, the worse the errors are and the more apparent they are. Okay. Well, all that's pretty cool. I find it pretty cool because there's an example of how something was true in 1675, and it's no longer the case as of 1975. Actually, by 1925, it was no longer the case. And so, I mean, here's, you know, yet we still can use it. As long as they use the limited concepts from the 17th century or 18th century or 19th century. Those limited concepts are fine. But when you get into more advanced concepts, they don't work. They just don't explain all kinds of things that are going on around us that we've become more aware of because we've increased our senses in all three bodies by increasing our technologies in the physical world, our astral nature to some extent, and our mental nature to a greater extent. By all those things, we have improved significantly our ability to sense. That's part of the process of growth. We're growing. Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of a break. There's a tiny one here, not too much. I want to mention again about 5G, some experiences we're having. One of the things I discovered is that most of the time when people give it as a gift or a suggestion or whatever to other people, I mentioned this before, but I'm going to bring it up again. It's a great analgesic. It's fantastic. But the person receiving it may not have the same enthusiasm, may not have heard anything about it from me or others that they'd be talking about it. And they may be someone frightened, even insecure about it. They may go to others who are the same, which doesn't help anybody. And so you don't have the confidence, and you may not use it right, or you may not use it at all. And so I'm going to recommend this, and it sounds a little strange. No matter how much you believe the GZIC works, either for yourself or if you haven't used it for yourself, but you think it works, don't give it to somebody else. Not unless you're going to stand there and watch them take it and talk to them about it. Don't give it to them to use it some other time because it's probably a waste. They may lose it, throw it out, or misuse it. And that's not a good thing. And it's not helpful. Take more responsibility for it then. If you really believe it's going to be helpful to somebody, well, have them take away your present while they're in the kind of pain that they want to deal with if you think you understand how best to use it. Or have them call us or contact us, us being a people who are involved in making it, myself, because that's another alternative. But the best thing is if they buy some themselves, just give them the money for it if you really feel that that's a good thing to do. Here's some money. Go get some. Yeah. But I don't think giving them the actual product, I think it might frighten people as much as it helps them. It puts pressure on them. Like, oh, gee, you gave it to me. I have to use it. You know, I'm afraid. I don't know. People are afraid of things they haven't tried, especially something with a funny name, like 5QI, which is Qi pronounced. Jesus, it sounds like, well, what is that, from another planet or something? What is that? Well, it's based on Eastern Chinese medicine. That's going to really give people confidence. Oh, I got that. And it's that crazy guy you listen to on Friday nights who talks about metaphysics and physics and all kinds of other goofy things. That's who you want me to take this thing from? Yeah. Think about it. Appreciate it. We definitely appreciate other people really have kind and very good things to say about some of the stuff that, you know, spiritual group I'm part of and other people that I'm involved with, they're good people, have helped to create. That's wonderful. I appreciate that. But sometimes it just doesn't work good to, you know, think that other people are going to be as open to something as we might be. We being anybody who is understanding of what we're using. I've given a couple of shows on, you know, the science of Phi Chi. And so people already have that in their mind, so if you're listening to a show, you'll be more open to probably trying it. The best thing that's going to happen over time, I don't know how fast this will be, is when enough people are starting hearing from a lot of other people. Well, I take some of this thing called Phi Chi Jizik. You know, I got rid of all my pain. I had no side effects. It's way better than the drugs I was taking. You know, and it's cool. It's good stuff. I mean, I feel better. I have less pain. Not just when I take it, but even when I'm not. Well, that's a good thing. That'd be cool. Yeah. So if you want to get some Phi Chi Jizik, you can go to the World Wide Web, www.phijizik.com. You can do that. Phijizik.com. If you have a computer and that's the way you like to shop for things. Or you can call 602-431-5762. That's 602-431-5762. And you can talk to somebody about it. Order it if you want. Tell them what kind of pain you have. Be straight with them. Say, well, is this going to probably work for me or not? Remember, if it doesn't work for you, send it back. Just you don't even have to send it back if you use it all up, actually. The truth is, just say, hey, you know, I didn't like this stuff. It didn't work. We'll cross you off our list. That means that we won't sell it to you again with a guarantee, but we'll send you back your money. Now, if you want to buy some again in the future and you say, well, maybe I was wrong about that, you can do so, but then the second time you don't get your money back if you don't like it. But really, this is a fair shot. This is a fair deal. We're saying you don't like it for any reason whatsoever. I don't care what the reason is. Then you get your money back. I think that's really fair. And, you know, and if you call us at least at this time and you're really unsure about it, we may send you a sample. I mean, seriously, we've done that with some people. You got to convince us that your fear is real. Okay. Because the samples cost us money, of course. Unfortunately, it's an expensive thing to make. And when something is expensive, you can't just give some away to everybody. I'd like to do that. I honestly would like to do that. Maybe we'll try that. Maybe for a week or two we'll have a Phi Chi Jizik sample week or something. People could get a sample for free no matter who they are, unless they have had it already and they know better. Well, that would be cool. I think that would be something worthwhile. It costs us a lot of money, but, and you know, to get people used to it, try it, you know. Maybe that's something we should be interested in. I'd like to hear your thoughts about that. So if you can email us and see if that's a reason you might try it, let me know. If not, or if you think it's stupid to do that, let me know that too. I would like to know, really. Okay, let's get back to God's mental dimension of mind. Why did God create this mental dimension of mind in the first place? I mean, God exists in a much higher dimension and exists at least in the sense of its mind. Its mind is composed of the first three dimensions of our universe. The mental dimension is the fifth. Why did it create this other mental dimension for its mind to be reflected in? And the reason is us. Human beings cannot get beyond the mental dimension. By definition, they can't sense well enough in any other dimension than the mental dimension is the highest dimension. And because of that, God said, you know, I need humans in this life plan I'm creating of growing myself to be the part of life that first discovers me on a fully conscious level. But in order to do that, there has to be a reflection of my own mind in the mental world, which is at the fifth dimension of time and space. much lower than where my mind really is, which is in the first three dimensions. So God said, I can do that. It's not that hard. I'll just make a reflection of the first three dimensions, all represented in the mental dimension, so that people can find me. In order to do that, you have to be able to think both conceptually, and you have to be able to think in form, thought forms, both near the same time. Humans are able to do this. Some pets of humans that are advanced mammals can do this. And a few mammals can do a little tiny bit of it that are advanced, that aren't necessarily pets. But that's it. That's the whole ballgame. Rest of life in the three lower worlds, uh-uh. So God did it mostly for humans and for those animals lucky enough and developed to be able to do so. But when we look at it from that standpoint, we're a key component in creating truth. Truth isn't going to be made by a bunch of salamanders. And human beings are a key component in why God went to the trouble of making a reflection of its own mind in one dimension of time and space. Now, let's talk about math. You heard me talk about formulas, math. How come math, then, is so prominent in the mental world? And why did that come about? Is that part of God's mirror? Sort of. Let me try to explain it this way. If you've taken much math, and even if you haven't, this, I think I can make this understandable. When we're doing equations and we're thinking about formulas, even it's a formula even to learn how to add and subtract or division. You learn a formula of how to do it. Everything is formulated in math. When we're doing that, what we're really doing is we're going through some of the three parts of the dimension. We're dealing with cause to come out with an effect in a mathematical sense. The cause is the theorem. The effect is the numerical answer. We're dealing with love wisdom. Now, this gets a little tricky here. We're dealing with love wisdom. You might say, well, what does love wisdom got to do with mathematics? You know, we're dealing with love wisdom because the reason that we pursue to understand man, and it's virtually humans that do this. I mean, animals, very minimal, but humans are big into this. The reason is because the math helps to divulge something that is truthful by bringing together our mind with the minds of others. You say, what are you talking about? How does our mind get closer to others because of mathematics? Because the, if you want to call it language, but the instrument of mathematics allows two people of completely different beliefs and thoughts, even of truths, to come to an agreement on a truth through the mathematics. Let me say that again. I'll say it a little bit differently. When you and five other people get together and you all disagree about some part of nature, and then you start doing mathematical formulas to prove or disprove each of your beliefs, and you finally come to a mathematical formula that all of you agree on because the formula itself is correct in terms of being supportive between the cause and the effect. The numbers work out to be the same as what the theorem says. Then you're closer together. That's how love wisdom comes in. I know that seems obtuse to us because we want to make it more emotional. And math seems so far from being emotional. But in a weird way, it is emotional in the sense that it is love. Scientists oftentimes deal with mathematics and theorems, etc. And in an odd way, scientists are loving in this strange way, which is a more masculine than feminine approach to the astral world, in which through mathematics that they can come to agreement when in every other way they may have disagreed. They allow math to be their instrument, their design for being closer together. Okay? I hope that didn't sound like it was way off in outer space there, but I think it's understandable. Okay, and then finally, what is the form manifestation? Well, once the numbers come out correctly, we use the mathematics to develop all kinds of things, that eventually become in the physical world, all of the engineering, all the technologies, all everything that are more third rate than fifth rate. Science is fifth rate, that's the third rate, which is the third part of God's mind being manifested. But again, it's a reflection for science. Wow. So it's all coming together. So that's why math is such a big deal in the middle world. That's why God invented math. God made a universe that has math as part of it, so that humans can find God. If you're a superhuman, you don't have to use mathematics because you can use a higher form than math. Math is a mental form. You can go to the intuitional plane and use Buddhic or intuitional thought and senses. And it goes way beyond math and way faster than math to solve things, to find the answers, etc. That doesn't mean you're excluded from using math. You could do both if you want. But in the Buddhic world, instead of sharing a mathematical formula that you get a mathematical numerical answer to, you share the sense of the other person. And through their senses and your senses, you can compare the senses so that then you can find a higher level of truth than you can through math. It's a different thing, a different experience, of course. Most humans don't have that ability yet. So they rely on math if they're scientists, or if they're just folks out there and are seeking another way of finding truth. Math is a good one. It also is not perfect. Be aware, and this is going to confuse some people. Isaac Newton, we talk about Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton created calculus. It was a great thing, you know, wonderful math. And there's two kinds. There's a thing called integral calculus, which has to do with the base numbers of things coming out the surface. And then there's differential calculus, which has to do with area underneath the graph. It tells you how things are happening in beyond two dimensions. And it's these two things can be brought together into a completed kind of math. But regardless, he creates this wonderful math. And the fact is that it wasn't correct. Because it's supportive of a mechanical universe with a God that is perfect already, and God is actually growing. So the problem with calculus is that you can't define where something is in both place and speed at the same time, because if you try to do one, you lose the accuracy of the other because of something called quantum anomalies due to quantum constant and problems in quantum physics. It has to do with probabilistic rather than absolutes. God is a probabilistic being growing itself through all of the unknown factors of its growth, which includes human beings. And you cannot, therefore, have an absolute understanding of anything at any time. Yep. And calculus was one way to try to get that. So it doesn't get there. It gets there for okay, big objects under slow speeds. The deal is something real big, under a relatively big, under a small, moving at a relatively small speed, nothing near the speed of light or anything like that, then calculus works fine. No problem. But if you're getting to the very fast-moving things, like how fast planets move and suns are moving through galaxies and other stuff like that, or how fast radio waves are moving, or light itself, and you're trying to get the correct answer using just calculus, you'll find the planets aren't quite moving the way they should be. You'll find everything is off. And suddenly you say, wait a second, Newton was pretty cool because he created all this wonderful math, but it only worked for the stuff that he could sense and understandings he had of his day. For us today, it's only good for things that are moving slowly and big, relatively big. Okay, so that's an interesting point, isn't it? Math has this problem. It is just like all other parts of the minds of men and the reflection of God's mind. It isn't the true God's mind. It's just a reflection that humans use. And therefore, as we grow, our math changes. Has to. And the math of yesterday may be inaccurate. I mean, it's not like a terrible thing. It's not like we're doing it deliberately. It's just the way it is. And it's another proof of what I'm talking about when I say the truth is relative and not absolute. Because God is relative and not absolute. And truth is the co-creation of us with God. If we're co-creating more of God and ourselves at the same time, then there can't be any absolutes, including truth. Because truth is one of those virtues. It's nothing to be ashamed of. We shouldn't be worried like, oh my, we can never find the truth. Well, you don't find truth, you create truth, and it's created at the moment, and tomorrow's truth might be different than today's. It's the best we can do until we can live beyond the mental world and live truly in a higher level of the future, where we join the three parts of time together more succinctly and more accurately, and we don't have the amount of kinds of illusions that we have right now. And so illusions are just lack of sense, is another way to look at it. Our senses are just greater and better and bigger, and we're more godlike in those other realms, higher realms. But we won't be human then. We won't call ourselves human and we won't be human. Our senses are so changed, so more developed dimensionally beyond the maniacic or mental world that we couldn't possibly be described accurately as being human. So I call them superhuman. Some people say they're masters or this, that, great beings, enlightened ones. They're probably all those things and beyond. But they are. Because they've created themselves into that by becoming a greater part of God, not by doing it completely alone from God. All right, hopefully this is all making sense. Fitting together, everybody's saying, wow, I never understood that before. But if I'm not getting there, you can, as an example, read about some of this stuff in Life's Hidden Meaning. Life's Hidden Meaning is a textbook that allows a person to take their own time to try to learn. You can also email me, but I can't really answer an email that involves a chapter in a whole book I wrote. So I can only answer very short kinds of questions. It's some personal questions I choose sometimes not to answer because people are on a journey about themselves, you know, and a shrink. Well, I used to be a psychotherapist, but not any longer. That's a long time ago in my past. And today, you know, what I do today is really different. I'm not trying to get people to reach a better understanding of their lower self, which is really what psychotherapy is about. I'm trying to help people become their soul. Some people call that their higher self. And trying to help people to function and interrelate with others as a soul. Really different kind of ball. Black. Or whatever. this kind of thing then means that tonight's show is meant to help everybody in the long run to function more as a soul. How does the soul function differently from a human being? Let's look at, again, now we're going back to the mental dimension to understand this. The souls of human beings exist in the higher or conceptual mental world. They do not exist in the lower mental. They understand truth in a totally different way than most human beings do. They don't test truth by thought forms like humans do. That may surprise you. So, and they don't really know much about the thought forms that we think of that are selfish because of that. Because they don't test their truths that way. They don't know their truths that way. Then you can say, well, how on earth do they know the truths? Since we do it by a lot of time, not all the time. Sometimes we think as a soul, I'm going to get to that. But we do it mostly by finding whether or not we can think of any examples of forms of thought, examples that of the truth that contradict the truth, and then we know the truth isn't the truth anymore. They contradict the concept, I should say. And we know the truth, that truth isn't coming out from that concept anymore. We either have to find a bigger concept that works, or we're stuck. That isn't how soul works. Let me try to describe this for you. Souls, instead, challenge a concept, not with forms of thought, but with lower and higher concepts. They exist in what is called the second mental subworld. And from the perspective of that subworld, they can think, to some extent, from the higher subworld above them, depending upon how well developed they are. They have this thing called petals that they can develop. And the ones that don't have any petals developed can't think at all. So they're not able to do what I'm just describing. Those are like a brand new young soul. They have no, they're like thoughtless beings at that point. But they start thinking as soon as they create a human being, which is usually with the help of another being greater than themselves to do for the first 100 or so lifetimes. They need help with this because it's so complicated. But nonetheless, I'm getting off the subject. So this, you're the soul, and you're in the second subworld, and now a concept that you experience, possibly from an incarnate that presently is maybe functioning in the mental world. But you experience this concept, and you want to know whether it's true. Well, the first thing you do is you compare it to the third subworld, which is below where you're at. And in that subworld, you experience pieces of that concept in lower form. And you challenge the higher form to see if any of the pieces of the lower form can integrate into the higher form without contradiction. If they can, then you feel, oh, some relief. Yes, I like that concept. I think that concept is truthful right now. However, you then also attempt to take those two pieces of the puzzle and see if you can create a higher concept in the first subworld where you don't exist yet. This is challenging. You may ask for assistance from a guide called a solar angel or an alternate, sort of your alter ego and mind. You don't share that being sense completely, but you share a little fraction of the sense. And so you use that little fraction of the sense to help you. And then you discover, well, you know, if I can create an even higher truth out of this, there's even more truth to it than I thought. And sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. When you can't, you know that at some point in the future, either distant or near, that truth is going to go away and something else is going to supplant it. If you can find that you can make a higher truth in the first subworld by creating a greater concept with the lower and the higher and the one you're used to together, then you know, wow, this is a truth that'll last for a while. This has great potential for longevity and truth. And that's better than you would do if you were comparing thought forms to the truth. You have a wider perspective of truth at that point, and you have a better understanding of how it's going to work in time, over time. You have a better understanding whether it's going to last for a short time or a long time. You don't gain that by comparing thought forms to concepts like human beings do. For the most part, you can't do it that way. But the souls can. And a human being can think like a soul if they live like a soul. I have to be of service to others, thinking out, focused out, be creating virtue as much as possible, and living an enlightened life. They can then start thinking like a soul and use this higher way of creating concepts and thinking in concepts and just using examples of thought. When they do that, they break the karma monastic connection that I told you was so terrible and has plagued human beings. How does it break it? Because the concept, there is no connection between a feeling and a concept, only between feelings and thought forms, or forms of concepts, only. There's no connection, direct connection. Concepts can invoke feelings from creating a series of thought forms. So you can have the higher creating of the lower, but they can't be affected by a feeling coming up from the astral world and getting past the lower mental. It won't work. The vibration of the feeling cannot exist in that way in the higher mental world. This won't work. Matter of fact, it can't really work very effectively beyond the fifth subplane, for those of you who understand what that means. So when you get to the fourth subplane, it's even very hard for the feeling to control even that subplane of the lower mental world. But regardless, that's going to confuse some listeners unless they understand all that, and I don't want to get into it tonight. But anyway, so the amazing thing about this is that this whole thing was designed by God, and it works. So if we become more of our souls, we automatically, every time we are, a little bit, we're a little bit breaking the common monastic connection. We become a lot our souls and we break it completely. And we're able to think in comparative concepts rather than comparative concepts and thought forms. We now have another great advantage. You ready for this one? Let's see how much time I've got. Oh, good, I got lots of time. Well, I got enough time anyway. We are now able to become super creative. Human beings are limited in their ability to create based upon what level of the conceptual mind they think in. If they think mostly from the third subworld, their concepts are so small that their ability to create is minuscule. They almost never create anything earth-shaking and never anything that profoundly improves their ability to connect with God and to move quickly into becoming more of a soul. The reason for that is the concepts themselves, remember, are causative. They cause us to be able to make an effect. If the cause is small, the effect is equally small, and our ability to become an overall creator is very, very limited. And the concepts that we use limit us in time. What that means is, like, unlike the soul that is able to pick and choose concepts that go way out into the future, we are only able to solve a problem right before us and on our nose in the present. And in such limited solution, we don't look at the bigger picture. We don't look for something that's hugely more effective, hugely better. We're always making little baby steps. Solve this problem, go get a patent quickly. Go on to the next little one. And then the next little. Maybe they expand a little bit over time, but there isn't this huge leap. People say, well, how did Einstein come up with the theory of relativity? Still based on classical physics, not quantum physics, at least in the beginning. How did he come up with it? He came up with it because he was able to get to the bigger picture, the bigger concepts. He thought in these bigger concepts, and he saw beyond what people were thinking. That's the difference That's the difference. So you become super creative by the standards that most humans are. I just think it's normal, but that other people would say, well, that's amazing. And once you become a super creator, you find very advanced solutions for things that most people haven't even realized are a problem yet. And you're already beyond that and into the next thing, see. You become an inventor par excellence, but an inventor of things that maybe people don't even know they need yet because they haven't seen the problem yet. And maybe there are 10 problems before that point. You see, this is the greatness of being a soul is wonderful, but at the same time, souls are avant-garde. Souls are so far ahead that sometimes the stuff they create aren't even discovered, rediscovered, for tens of years to decades beyond that and to centuries and who knows. Because you can be that far ahead. That's possible. Now, you try to bring it, and souls try to bring it down to where people are at the time. But not always can that be done. Because people block or prevent. Those that cannot create become hostile to those that can. Why is that the case? You would think they'd be thankful. Thanks for creating when I wasn't. Why is that? Well, because of this thing about egotism. It's a deflating element to a person's self. Some people refer to it as ego. I don't like that word. To a person's lower self, it deflates their lower self to know that someone is creating at a much greater rate than they are. And they become crippled by it in an emotional sense because they're still kabbalistically connected, right? And then that makes it worse for them. Instead of becoming more creative by the challenge, they become more non-creative. Move away from the challenge. This is a problem. How often does it happen? All the time. As a matter of fact, it's the main proponent of why people become egotistical. In the first place, during our younger years, usually between the ages of about 14 and 21, while we're developing our mental body and our sense of ability to create concepts and join them significantly and challenge them with forms of thought forms, while we're doing all that, we become challenged by those who can do it much better. As a defense of that challenge, we either become humble and seek to understand how they're doing it better, and especially if they're doing it on a soul level. If we're taught this soul level business, we get around all this, you see. But most people aren't. If we're brought into it, if it's part of our life in a spiritual sense, it's great. But it isn't for so many people these days. And so what happens is that we become more and more egotistical. As a defense to a feeling of loss of self, which is somewhat real to us. Well, if I can't conceptually understand what someone else can, then I don't want to know that they can. And they are more conceptually capable than I am. And they have better mental senses, therefore, than I am. But as soon as you become egotistical, you then damage your senses even further. So it's a never-ending decline from this superb mind that humans are actually given by being human beings, we can destroy ourselves and make ourselves into like lower level animals. So we're barely thinking in any concepts at all. And all the concepts we use are grossly wrong, grossly, and yet we live our life by them. Of course, that leads to terrible mistakes in a life of misery and no meaning from life. Because the biggest thing concepts do, at least to the lower self, is it provides meaning. When you understand concepts about all the things around you, all the causes for all the effects you're experiencing, things start adding up and you can bring them together and you find God. And that's the most meaningful thing you can find. You can find yourself as part of God and other people as part of God and yourself, therefore, as a soul. It's truly an amazing process. And we have this ability to do this stuff. But we start learning during our early teenage years to not do that. And we become intractable as we approach the later teenage years into the early 20s. We become intractable to the point where we may not learn a lot of different things because it's against our present mistaken levels of thinking. People that do that drop out of school, oftentimes. Their life becomes very mundane and meaningless. Now, some people continue, but they'll tailor the courses and schools they go to, if they go into school, or what they read and learn, because schooling isn't necessarily an educational body. It could be an education through reading and other things, and talking to people and mentoring. But regardless, if you're open-minded and you function, you live as a soul, you can't just be open to it. You can't. That's like meditation solving everybody's problems. No, you have to go out and serve. But if you're open and serving, then it's wonderful because you grow immensely in your open-mindedness, and suddenly all these new and greater and greater and greater concepts become reality. Some of you realize that because you listen to the show and you know that that's what you're experiencing, I hope. But the point is that some people don't do that, but they go on to take some kind of courses and become some kind of profession. That's a cover-up. Why did people do that? Because it protects them from getting into too big of concepts. They narrow the concepts and they specialize their thought into one or two or three areas or whatever it is, usually around a profession. And then that makes it comfortable for them to become more and more egotistical and eventually arrogant. You see, this is not something that by accident happens to people. It happens to people because that's the way they choose to live. Now, why doesn't God do something about this? Why doesn't God make the mental dimension so that when people do this, a little hammer comes to hit you in the head and says, bang, 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 you know, start thinking in larger concepts that are more whole and get your act together. Well, we do have a conscience. That's this other part of this other being that is helping our soul. And it'll say, you know, you're not being very virtuous right now. But a long time ago, we learned to ignore that, especially through egotism. That's one of the ways we can. Then in addition to that, that isn't sometimes going to get us to think more conceptually. It may get us to become more faith-based in our relationship with God. It may be for various reasons to try to be virtuous, but not from a conceptual side. That still blocks us from being our soul. I know that sounds terrible because some people who are wonderful people, who are amazingly good people in some ways, and who are very, very either religious and or very, very devoted to their faith in God, no matter what religion they are, no matter what God it might be to them. The problem is you've got to also add the conceptual side or you can't become your soul. Why not? Because here is the big problem. God can't bang you over your head because the soul is in the way. The soul has to become a mini-God to us. The soul has to allow us freedom. Freedom to think, freedom to make mistakes, freedom to be selfish, freedom to reject it if that's the case. That's what the soul is doing, the same as God is doing to the whole universe. Because the soul knows God and knows that that's the right thing to do. The soul already has that concept. We don't. The problem is that there's no way for God to intervene and bang us in the head because it would be doing injustice to the soul by interfering and injustice ultimately to us. We have to be free. If we're not given the freedom to screw up, the freedom not to think in big concepts, the freedom to think in crazy, non-connected, untruths, completely nonsense concepts, if they're concepts at all. If we have that right, then we have the ability to grow beyond it. But we have to do so based upon our own efforts. Sorry, Nobody's going to go bang you in the head and tell you, well, you should have done something else. You should be thinking more conceptually. Oh, I might tell you that if you're around me, but that's something different. Because another human being can help another human being. But our souls won't. And God can't. And souls actually can't either because they follow God. I know it's a bitter pill. I've had students, because I have some students. I'm a student, but I have some students. And students sometimes want me to think for them. Why don't you tell me my concepts, what I should be thinking in? You know I'm not doing it. Help me. Well, what's the problem? First of all, you can't because it's a sense. It's like someone say, take my senses and make them better. You can't take their senses. Their senses are their senses. Right? And so part of it is a sense, and that the sense has to grow. But in addition, the interference, truly, of doing someone else's conceptual thinking for them all the time is not good for them. It does not provide them with the necessary ingredients for their own growth. And it may cripple them worse than you could ever imagine. The judicious, which means love, wisdom kind of thing to do, is to make sure that you only give them a hint or a help, but never the solutions for what they would like so someone else is thinking for them. Don't think for others. Help them to think for themselves. That's a pretty good idea. If we can all live by that love wisdom, it would be great. Well, you know, we're running out of time. Let me try to, I got about 1 minute here to kind of summarize this. You know, let me just say this. That if this show has made much sense to you, but you still say, well, you know, this is way, re-listen to the show. It's easy. You just go online. You can do it through the station or you later on. The station gets it first, so you go there. But if you can't or decide you don't want to, you can come to eventually our site. We'll have it up there. And re-listen to the show. When you listen to the show a second time, you'll know what you're looking for more, and you'll get a lot more out of it, and your consciousness will be a bit higher from having listened to it the first time. That's the best I can do for right now. And we are out of time. So I want you to consider this, that if this has made sense to you, and if you say, gee, yes, I want to create more truth, etc., why not make that a commitment for yourself in terms of the way you're going to live your life? Why not make it that you're not just going to tell the truth, which is a bunch of nonsense, but you're going to help create truth in other people's minds? You're going to make it so that they and you can live as souls as one together. And you're going to really be of service to other people, including the things you get out of this show. Help others by having them listen to the show with you and then discuss it afterwards. Get a group of people together to do that. That would be a tremendous service to everybody, believe me, it would, if you believe the show is worthwhile. Okay, well, listen, we are out of time. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.